This is the Infotagem podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. In the last few years, we've seen the growing problem of racism and hate speech on social media, which has also corresponded with an increase in reports of hate crimes to the police. This is a problem that affects the whole of society, but people in the public eye, including sports people and celebrities, are particular targets. I'm Damien Collins, and in this podcast, we'll be discussing these issues with Sanjay Bhandari, Chair of Kick Racism Out of Football, and Charlie Brooks, Director of Communications at Manchester United. We'll also be hearing from our resident expert, the disinformation analyst, Charles Creel.
Sanjay, it's fantastic to have you with us on the Infotagem podcast. We've spoken quite a bit on the podcast in the last few months around the way in which social media can incite violent acts. You know, we've seen it recently discussing it in India with attacks on minority communities being organized on social media. We saw it in America around the 6th of January with the uprising in Washington, D.C. But something that probably in the UK we're more familiar with is the way in which football players become the subject of racist abuse in a way that would not be tolerated at all if it took place in the community or in a football stadium, but which has increasingly become a problem on social media. And from the excellent work you do at Kick It Out, I'd be interested in your thoughts about, you know, how we address that and what we need to do to combat it.
Yeah, morning. I think there's lots that we can do, that we should do. I mean, I think there's sort of three levels. There's what should social media be doing, what should the government be doing, and what should football be doing. I think really probably just to start off with this is really a societal problem and a football problem. It is both. I mean, it's a bit of chicken and egg, isn't it? And people, this is the question that we often get asked: is this a football specific problem, or is it a societal problem? And that actually the reality is it's both. It is a societal problem, but it does play out more acutely in football. And that's because what we're seeing, I think, is a broader shift to tribalism, particularly as the great political divide now is no longer left versus right, but more open versus closed. And every issue seems to be a matter of identity and culture wars, and whether you're either open or closed. That seems to be the primary divide. Now, football has always been tribal, and football has always had the anonymity of the crowd. And so the challenges that you have in stadia are built around tribalism and the anonymity of the crowd. And guess what? Social media amplifies both of those so that it becomes a hiding place. I think, you know, in terms of resolving that, you know, we've got things that we're doing, I suppose, with the social media companies, where we as a football community are engaged with them. But there are also things that we're doing without them. So the things we're doing with them, we convene this online hate working group, which includes Twitter and Facebook. I think it's quite rare to get them both in the same room. But you know, that includes the FA, the Premier League, the PFA, the LMA, a whole bunch of other organisations in and around football. And there we're focused on the practical realities of what are the things that we can be doing now, because whatever the law is now is going to be that way for the foreseeable future. It's going to take a little bit of time before it changes. The things that we're doing without social media are primarily around, you know, really encouraging the government to regulate. And you know, I've spent 30 years working in heavily regulated industries, and my experience is technology is one of the most under-regulated industries of all the industries that have a daily impact on our lives. Technology is the most under-regulated.
It's a subject we discuss a lot on this podcast. And I mean, I'd like to come back to ask you about the government's online harms bill, I think, which is one of the areas of legislation where some action could be taken here. But we're going back to sort of the point I think you read about culture. I mean, it was the case in the 1970s and the 1980s that you would hear racist chanting in football grounds. And whilst that may not have been totally eliminated, I think the atmosphere on the whole is a lot better than it was. And, you know, I think also we've seen, you know, recently, well, if we think back to the time when fans were allowed in stadia, we've seen players taking action as well, players walking off, you know, games being stopped if there is racist abuse. But in this country, I think a sense that the progress has been made. But that changing culture of what happens within a stadium does not seem to have been matched with the culture that exists on social media, where people use their anonymity to behave in a way that they probably would never think of behaving in real life.
Yeah, and it has crept back a little bit into Stadia as well. And, you know, I've been going for 30 or 40 years, and I know sort of both anecdotally and empirically we've got some evidence of that. So, you know, if you look at progress, does not move in a straight line, and it's wrong to think about these things as in a linear flow. You know, my experience is societal issues around discrimination and this kind of hate and abuse goes in cycles, and very often correlated with the economic cycle, because when times are hard, people look for easy figures to blame, and people who look different, people who are of immigrant heritage, tend to be quite easy figures to blame. So you tend to see a little bit of spike in discrimination around those times of economic hardship and during that period of the economic cycle. But if you look back, yeah, to 40, 50 years ago, is football in a much better shape in terms of discrimination and equality? Absolutely. And I certainly would see the kind of people that I see following my team home and away, you know, there are far more people now who look like me in a ground than, you know, in the 1980s. But the reality is, over the last 5 years, things have definitely got worse. And that correlates with the Home Office's hate crime statistics as well. So these things don't, it isn't sort of a straight line. And things have got there have been some, you know, some evidence that we've seen from the discrimination reports we receive, that there's been a rise in Stadia abuse as well. But I think there's a sense that that's much more controlled or controllable, because we've got such a history from tackling hooliganism in the early 1990s of good policing and good stewarding and lots of evidence. And so it feels like that's more controllable. Social media is completely and utterly out of control. It is the Wild West. So, you know, that really is the modern battleground of hate. It is the biggest problem area.
And, I mean, it's interesting you say, you know, you think it's got worse over the last 5 or 6 years, and you're right. And the Home Office's statistics on hate crime show, you know, a steady rise in incidents of hate crime in the UK. And is social media a contributing factor? Because we know from, you know, looking back over history, that if you have an environment where hate speech becomes normalised, where people see more and more of it, it can have an accelerating effect unless something is done about it. And do you think that the change in atmosphere you've detected within football grounds, do you think that's being influenced by the growing prevalence of hate speech on social media?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think social media is the great amplifier. I think it's real life on steroids. And that's part of the joy of it, because you look at the amazing things that can happen on social media. Look at the way, you know, Captain Sir Tom Moore's fundraising, you know, really accelerated by social media and amplified by that. So you see all the great things of human life there, but we also see the cesspit of human life there. And that's what we're often now seeing in football with hate. And it does amplify things that are already existing, and, you know, moving people into these sort of echo chambers where all they ever see is opinions that match their own. And being policed, you know, I heard of something the other day of someone, you know, being criticised for some people they follow. Well, I mean, if I got criticised for people I follow, I'd never work, because I follow people that I disagree with, because they're the people whose opinions I need to change, and in order to change them, I have to engage with them and understand them. But that's the society we live in today, and it's amplified by social media. I'm going to get called out for following someone that I shouldn't be following. I should be cancelled because I shouldn't be following a particular person because they have a different opinion to me. Now, that's part of the cultural problem that we have, and it's massively amplified by social media.
Now, with regards to the online harms bill that the government is planning to introduce, the UK government's planning to introduce this year, obviously, that will define harmful content and create a legal duty of care for companies to remove harmful content where it exists. Now, I think the role here of speech which is, I think hate speech and speech that is clearly inciting violence against individuals will clearly be covered by that. But there is this debate as well about speech which may not necessarily be threatening an individual, but could be considered harmful to society as a whole. And I think it's really important that's reflected in the bill, because racist speech, even if not directed at an individual, could still lead to others taking violent actions against anyone they perceive to be, anyone who's part of any minority community, as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, it's the sort of the dog whistle stuff that's almost the most dangerous, actually, in many ways. And of course, those are the difficult grey areas, and it's the kind of thing that I think needs to be envisaged by the bill. I think actually, in many ways, though, the area I'm most interested in is supervision. So, I come from 30 years of being in sort of law, technology, compliance, and I've worked a lot in the regulated industries. And my experience is, yes, one thing to focus on the enforcement jurisdiction. Actually, it's the supervisory powers that can sometimes be the most powerful, the ability to create a thematic review, to have, reporting processes. I think those are some of the things that, it's the boring mechanics that often make the difference, the very small things things that appear to be very small. And those are some of the things really that we're focusing on. So I'm getting some external legal advice, looking at, thankfully, a big international law firm has agreed to give us some pro bono advice, to do that sort of regulatory comparison and to look at mechanisms that have worked elsewhere so that we can make concrete suggestions to DCMS about how the legislation ought to be improved so that we can create an ability to monitor and supervise on an ongoing basis. The definitions of what constitutes hate, you've probably got to create some mechanism that's got the flexibility to reflect contemporary mores, because that's going to change over time as to what we regard as hateful and criminally hateful conduct. It's different now to what it was 10 years ago. It'll be different again in 10 years' time. And when we legislate, we have to build that flexibility in.
But you, on this point about, hateful speech that is directed, not necessarily just, is not threatening imminent physical harm to an individual person, but not just that sort of speech, but speech which could be targeted at an entire community should be included in the scope of the bill.
Absolutely. And it's actually part of the challenge we currently have with the way in which we monitor for online hate, because it's mostly complaint-driven. And when it's complaint-driven, actually the confines and the ambit of your complaint and any criminal prosecution is just that one individual case. So one of the things I've been talking about with CPS and law enforcement is what happens, isn't that missing the culture online, which is those repeat offenders who any individual, one individual, post might not meet quite the threshold that you're talking about. But when they're doing 20, 30, 40, and they're doing lots of this every week, actually, they're the people that create the culture online. They're the people who light the fire. And they're the ones that we also ought to be after, because even those accounts which are bot-driven, there's still a directing mind and will behind that. There's a human being ultimately behind all of these things. And I think, I think I'm agreeing with you, really. We do need to capture that kind of conduct that creates the atmosphere of hate online. Look, there's always going to be some difficulty in crafting the wording of legislation to capture that, but we need to capture that.
And I just want to ask you, and then I want to ask Charlie the same question as well, is when you sit down in front of the social media companies to discuss these things from them, what sort of response do you get?
Well, obviously, more often than not, we're sat down here in the UK with some local UK people. Sometimes we have some global policy folks involved. And almost by definition, the people that are there with us, they say all the right things, they want to help. And actually, I believe that they sincerely want to help and want to drive change. But there are some issues that are above their pay grade. And I think many of the issues that we're dealing with here are ultimately above their pay grade, because they really all come back down to Section 230, and it all comes back down to the business model, and it all comes back to, are you a platform or are you a publisher? And they're always going to be guarded about that. And so that's why really the only way to cut that Gordian knot is to regulate them. And that's both here and in the US in particular, because once you're regulated in your home state, then that will make an even more significant difference. So I don't doubt the sincerity of the people that we actually speak to, but I think there are some things that are more fundamental to the business model of those organizations which they're swimming against internally.
Yes, well, I know from experience that the number of times you get told that, this is a very high priority for us, we have systems in place to deal with it. You ask them a direct question they can't answer, they always have to circle back and come back to you with an answer. So, but when you boil it all down, as you say, Section 230 is important because in their heart of hearts, they believe the harm is being caused by the people posting the content, not by them, even though they're the ones that are amplifying it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it all comes back to US economic and industrial strategy of the late 1990s, which is why that was in there, because it was 230 was created so as not to stifle a growing industry. And of course, ultimately, that will also be the answer. It will be US economic and industrial strategy. And the fact is that China is probably ahead in the three biggest technologies of the next 20 to 30 years, which is AI, quantum computing, and blockchain. And so it may be that our best defense is actually the fact that the US may want to regulate now, just as a defense mechanism to defend Silicon Valley. And we've kind of started to see that with Huawei and 5G, using their soft power to try and create a competitive advantage and using regulation to keep China out. That actually may be ultimately the thing that that creates change here.
Yeah. Charlie, I mean, you at Manchester United and your role there as Director of Communications, I mean, you've been involved in having to deal with and respond to players in particular being targeted. And I mean, it's a sad reflection today that really any kind of public figure, be it a politician, a pop star or a footballer, can be the subject of online abuse. And we've seen it directed against players like Paul Pogba, even Marcus Rashford. And how do you deal with that as a club?
Yeah, I think I'd echo some of the things Sanjay said. I mean, one of the interesting points he made is that progress is not linear. And you referred there to, the situation in stadiums in the 70s and 80s with open mass racist abuse. And over time, it was ignored for a long time. And then gradually it was seen as unacceptable. And then gradually there were steps to clamp down on it. And then gradually there was legislation and a shifting in what was acceptable. And all of those things combined to reach a situation where it was no longer acceptable, and the vast majority of right-thinking fans would self-police and clamp down on it, and there were facilities put in place to help that. And I think what we're going to see is a process that took maybe 20 years in stadiums compressed into quite a short amount of time by the debate that's happening now around social media, and part of that is regulation, as you said. I think it's important that we don't paint this as football against the social platforms. That's a very simplistic way to do it, and I don't think that benefits anyone. I'd echo Sanjay that when we've met with Twitter, with Facebook, they want to work together. They are proactive. They are helpful. It is by definition, when you meet with their UK operation, helpful to a point, because the bigger issues are around their broader policies that are governed out of California, and they have taken steps to address some of the immediate issues, or at least some of the immediate symptoms. There is better reporting processes. There is a willingness to work with football clubs like ourselves, with the Premier League, with Kick It Out. I think, let's be honest, part of that is because they know there is a PR issue for them there. But I don't doubt that they're also doing it for the right reasons. The big elephant in the room, of course, is online anonymity. And that seems to be a red line for those platforms. But I think that's important as well, to differentiate between, some people are painting this as, well, you need government identification, passport, driving license, nothing else would do. And if the other end of the scale, you have the current situation of complete anonymity and the ability to open multiple accounts and to almost abuse people at will. I think within that gap, there is a sliding scale. And I think that it's not beyond the realms of possibility to have measures in place that provide a deterrent to people who want to abuse anonymity by being abusive online. And that's what they have to look at. But it will become a regulatory issue for them, combined with ongoing pressure from ourselves, from football industry. And the other point I'd agree with Sanjay is this isn't purely a football problem. It seems almost, it's quite incongruous to have the director of communications from a football club and the head of a very forward-thinking anti-racist in football organisation or anti-discrimination football organisation discussing this, what is one of the great problems of society. Football is simply a very newsworthy lightning rod for it. And, you know, to Sanjay's point, football and tribalism have always gone hand in hand. So, you know, there's an element of the manifestation of competition between teams you see carried out online on social media as well. But we're quite aware at Manchester United that we risk this being seen as a Manchester United problem because it's newsworthy when it happens to Manchester United players. This is happening to players up and down the football pyramid, and this is happening to people outside football. They're just not as newsworthy as when it happens to high-profile clubs and high-profile individuals.
Indeed, I remember a couple of years ago on the DCMS Select Committee, we had two former Love Island contestants, and they, you know, as far as they were concerned, it was, you know, it was just sadly something you had to deal with. You know, racist abuse was something that you had to deal with, and you found ways of managing it and trying to, you know, avoid seeing it. But it was just part of being in the public eye. So I think you're right; it affects any kind of public figure, regardless of what they do. And I think, as Sanjay was saying, that, you know, we've seen this general rise in hate crime over the last 5 or 6 years, and part of the manifestation of that within football is, I think, this factor of abuse being directed at players through social media. But sometimes I can have one area where I have sympathy with the tech companies would be that if something happens very fast, there's some particular incident and there's a big reaction to it online, you can always be playing catch up a little bit to try and deal with it. But actually, when you've got something very specific, if you've got, you know, a consistent network of accounts targeting abuse at an individual, using particular hashtags, tagging in their account, and therefore you can see that it's happening, and you know that it's happened before, or say for a player like Paul Pogba, who's suffered abuse on a number of occasions, you could say, well, actually, surely we can build a system around someone like that who we know is likely to be a target and try and protect them. And how willing are the companies to have those sorts of conversations with you about that?
I think that falls back into Sanjay's point about they might be willing to have a conversation, but it always comes back to, well, we'll have to talk to California and come back to you on that. I think it is a good point. I mean, one of the things you hear is, well, you know, surely the players should just come off Twitter, which I find, you know, very sad, because, you know, social media has provided a revolutionary platform for players, for celebrities, for people in the public eye, for everyone to communicate. And the idea that, well, this is going to keep happening, so they just have to come off social media is ludicrous to me. And the platforms will engage with improved monitoring, as I said. They will engage with sort of improved reporting. There's a lot more that can be done. There's a lot more that can be done on AI and automated reporting to stop the vast majority of posts making out there to start with. We're currently in an unfortunate situation where, because this is newsworthy, every single individual time it happens will feed that news cycle. And we're very conscious of that. The reality is it's been happening for quite a while. It will go on happening when the news cycle drops down about it, as it inevitably will, until the next time it comes up. But I would agree that the platforms know that they have a serious issue here, and they are going to have to tailor things, given that football seems to be this ongoing lightning rod for every bigger debate on social media and what constitutes behaviour on social media.
Well, I think you're right. I think for the response to be, well, the players, you know, should come off social media is the wrong response, because, you know, social media allows fans to engage with a club like Manchester United and its players in a way they could never have done before. And even if we look at the success of, you know, Marcus Rashford's campaign around school meals, it probably would have been impossible to do something like that without social media. So we can see, you know, how people can engage around positive themes and issues. But for me, this is a concerning thing where we've got a problem they know that exists. There may be some networks of accounts that we know are behind it, and they're behaving in a consistent way. And as Sanjay said, it's not necessarily just one particular tweet which is clearly inciting violence. It's the steady drumbeat of abuse that can happen over a period of time that can be more damaging. And I think my view is, when we think about the online harms legislation and the role a regulator might play, I think they should take a tougher stance on stuff that is easy to see for the tech companies, easy for them to find and easy for them to do something about.
Yeah, the other issue, I think, is what happens when things get reported. because the reality, and Sanjay touched on this earlier on, you know, our CPS process is a victim-led process. It requires a victim to identify the harm that's been done to them. Players and high-profile celebrities and high-profile people generally don't want to engage with that process if they don't have to. They know it will create more publicity. They know it will simply feed the newsworthiness of the issue. So that's one thing. Another thing is our analysis shows that some of the abuse our players, or you know, a decent percentage of the abuse our players are getting, doesn't come from the UK. So then you have an entire different process of reporting and tracking and monitoring and going to those domains and saying, okay, are you able to help us? Now, the Premier League has a process in place, and the Premier League has been very proactive on putting a process in place to look at instances of abuse that happen from outside the UK, but it is inevitably a long and complicated process. It's frankly a long and complicated process when it happens in the UK within our own policing and jurisdiction. When it happens abroad, it's very, very difficult to trace it through the relevant national authorities and to bring somebody to justice, so to speak. And that feeds the sense of anonymity and the sense of that they can't be touched from these people, because it's very difficult to bring people to justice and to expose people and to make an example of people doing this. And the people doing that know this.
We've had an issue we've discussed on the podcast before has been research done looking at the behavior of orchestrated disinformation networks and campaigns. And on the whole, they work, they like tribalism. They like communities at war with each other, and they try and find topics that will do that. And there's been evidence of, for example, I think in Italy, Facebook groups being set up principally to talk about football, which then suddenly flip and start talking about other issues. I've seen analysis done by other research companies looking at, you know, networks based overseas that just pick the most divisive topic on any particular day and move between, you know, it might be football one day, it could be Black Lives Matter, it could be something to do with anti-vaccine campaigns on coronavirus, and they just flip from subject to subject. And I wondered, you know, from your position at Manchester United, whether, you know, you've seen things like that as well.
I'll be honest, in our analysis, we're focused on the posts that are being made against our players. And so we haven't gone that step up to analysis of bigger transnational dark forces at work. I'm sure it could happen. I'm sure it does happen. I would think that anybody who wants to inspire divisiveness or hate is going to find it quite a crowded space, to Sanjay's earlier point. But that's not something we've seen. I mean, what we at United have looked at is we brought together all of our sort of initiatives in the anti-discrimination field a few years ago under the banner of this All Red, All Equal as a campaign. And we focused on sort of campaigning against discrimination. We're going to be launching a new campaign that really focuses much more directly on the social media problem and encourages reporting in the same way as in the stadium. We have a culture of, you know, tell the stewards if this is happening. There is an anonymous virtual steward text service you can text in the stadium in non-coronavirus times. And we really want to put the onus on our fans, the vast majority of whom are appalled at this, to report as well. And that'll be the next phase of the campaign. Now, whether there are bigger, darker forces at work trying to inspire divisiveness wherever they can find it, that's a question for other people rather than ourselves as a club, I think.
Sure. But I think you're right. I think, as you said earlier on, I think it's fantastic you're doing that work. The big thing there is what happens when it's reported. You know, what do the companies do in response to this activity being reported to them? But Charles, you've been listening in. Appreciate probably football is a bit off your beat, but as long as you don't use the word soccer, I think we'll be interested to hear what you say.
The football bit without helmets, I don't understand so well, but thank you for considering that. Anyway, I'm really fascinated by this conversation because it really, the baseline subject, because we're talking about racism, is about white nationalism, which is a universal issue across Europe and North America right now, and the rise of the far right. And I'm just wondering, if y'all see the racism and radicalism playing itself mostly out on the big players like Twitter and Facebook, or do you see it coming from other spaces? Like, for example, Parler, which is not a problem right now because it's been shut down, they've just appointed a new co-CEO who is Matthew Richardson, and they're about to relaunch. And this looks like it will become a problem in this space here in the UK. Or do you see it on football forums and more specialist spaces?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, Sander, Charlie, I mean, is it mainly Facebook and Twitter, or have you seen this activity starting elsewhere?
So my sense, and I suspect John, who's got a similar experience, is that it's mostly Twitter and Facebook because that's where the players are. So with Facebook, we actually mean Instagram, really, because that's also where the money is in terms of being able to monetize your social media presence with brands. So that's really where the challenge is. I mean, I think, you know, separately, where Charles, that there's the far right is a challenge. Actually, it's part of a broader challenge for all social media, which is where does racism in football fit in the hierarchy of all the big challenges that big social media companies, particularly Facebook and Twitter, have to deal with? Well, they have to deal with counterterrorism. They have to deal with the rise of the far right. They have to deal with disinformation. They have to deal with political interference. They have to deal with COVID anti-vax conspiracies. Actually, racism in football is probably relatively low, far down their list. Part of the problem is, actually, we just don't have, with all the abuse that we see on Facebook and Twitter, we just don't have that taxonomy of offenders. And it's one of the things I've talked about with Twitter and Facebook is, you know, if I look at something like the hacking space, we have an established taxonomy. We know whether this is a kid in their bedroom doing it as a challenge. We know whether it's industrial espionage. We know whether it's a ransomware attack. We know whether it's state-sponsored. We've got that taxonomy. And there may well be a similar taxonomy here of different actors, but we haven't got a clue who they are because no one's doing that analysis and no one's going scratching below the surface. So we're engaged in this constant game of whack-a-mole where all that happens is an abusive post goes up and we all run around trying to whack that mole down and getting rid of that account, and then it pops up again. And so actually what I'm really interested in is that taxonomy of offenders underneath, which is partly what you're hinting at. My sense is that the sort of extremist far right that you're talking about are not mobilizing so much on Facebook and Twitter in relation to footballers, that they're not active in that space there, and they may well be active in Parler and other spaces. There may be, and my sense is that they are active in doing other things like anti-vax conspiracies and then going out from there into other activity.
It's interesting what you say about racism in football perhaps being relatively low on the priority list, because certainly football must be relatively high on the priority list because it's the world's most popular sport and has an unbelievable audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe it's more important to some than others. So maybe it's more important to Twitter than it is, for instance, to Facebook or Instagram. You know, and part of the strategies in how you deal with this might be, so one of the things I suggested last week was maybe as football, we could get together and create an RFP for a preferred provider that will only go with one, and we'll only go with the one which has better safety record, and we'll take every player off one and go on to another. You know, that might suddenly become more of a collective action that's got some meaning to it. And actually going to force people to the table, because the reality is you're not going to force these people to the table unless, you know, meaningfully, unless you've got regulation or money. Those are the things that people react to. So, you know, also looking at how do we engage with advertisers to start upping the ante. It's a significant challenge to get them to pay attention to this, even though football is the most popular game in the world, and even though the Premier League is the most popular league in the world, we've still got to put it into context. There are 4,000 members of the PFA, current players in the Premier League. There are 300 million users of Twitter and 2.7 billion on Facebook. You know,
okay, but each group probably has the same amount of money.
I don't think anyone has as much money as Facebook. This is a nation state we're talking about here.
I think there's some interesting, you know, we get told or we get questions, why don't you guys just come off Twitter or Facebook and your players come off Twitter and Facebook? And we could do that, and potentially all the Premier League clubs could come off Twitter and Facebook symbolically for a week or a month, or it would be a symbolic gesture that would be newsworthy. It would be a PR issue for those companies. the reality of it is that the Premier League clubs are not huge advertisers on those platforms. So there would be a symbolic news value to it. There wouldn't be a real meaningful value to it. And I would echo what Sanjay said before as well. I mean, I worked before at United at a large multinational brand that's headquartered in the States. And when an issue is huge in a smaller market, albeit an important one that the UK undoubtedly is, getting traction with the decision makers at the top level of the company based in the States can be difficult. And yes, it gets reflected and it gets fed up the chain, but there are many other priorities for those brand, for those platforms to be dealing with: terrorism, religious discrimination, all kinds of things, political interference, as Sanjay said. And trying to get traction with the decision makers in the US will be a challenge. And that's where regulation and or real commercial influence has to come to bear.
I think it's very interesting you say that, Charlie. But do you think that if you look at the way that companies like Twitter take enforcement action against copyrighted material? So, you know, if I'm, you know, if my Man United app has told me United has scored, and I think, I'd say, I'll go on Twitter to see if anyone's got the footage of the goal. You'll find quickly, as we all know, you know, things that people have filmed at home, probably filming the replay of the goal being scored from their television and posting it. But that stuff gets taken down quite quickly. You'd expect to see within a few minutes notifications of content being removed because it's been posted in breach of copyright. And I mean, do you think they move faster on some of those issues where there's maybe a commercial imperative to do so, but are less decisive when it comes to hate speech?
Well, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to say that's the case. Clearly, they have to do that in conjunction with the governing bodies and the leagues that they're working with. And in some cases, it's the same group that might be, you know, patrolling the platform for that as patrolling it for hate speech or abusive language. I think what's important is that there is a big move towards automation of monitoring. But they will say, and they're right, that automation doesn't take into account context. So you could see the N-word being used, but it's people saying, I can't believe people are using this word. You know, why don't they get a grip of themselves? Context wouldn't take that into account, or automated monitoring wouldn't take that context into account. So you have to have a mixture of automated monitoring, artificial intelligence, and human moderation. Now, only the platforms can answer whether the levels of human moderation they have and automated moderation match the same level of monitoring they have on things like pirated material.
Absolutely. But I mean, it could also be that, you know, alongside an education campaign to say that, you know, really, we'd really appreciate it if you didn't use some words, regardless of the context in which you use them, because, you know, the use of those words, you know, it helps people to spread hate who do intend to do it maliciously.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. That is a good point. And the other thing of seeing, of course, is use of emojis, particularly on Instagram. You're seeing three or four emojis that are being used in a racist context continuously. Now, the platforms that develop the emojis, Apple and Android mainly, they would say, well, you know, we can't restrict use on legitimate emojis because they're being used in another context elsewhere. That then becomes a case for machine learning and human moderation to be able to say, clearly these emojis have been used on Twitter or Instagram in a negative and racist context, and therefore we're going to track them and be able to, when we find them, not only delete the posts, but delete the accounts. And this is another problem we're seeing, where people are reporting racist abuse online on social platforms and being told it doesn't violate our policies. So somewhere within the automated system, they've decided it isn't racist when it clearly is. And then people doing it are being allowed to either take the posts down and then come back on that account, or simply reopen new accounts. And that's where, as Sanjay says, we're just in a game of whack-a-mole. The difference is the moles are multiplying in the background, and the same mole can keep coming out of different holes 25 times.
Before we close, I mean, do you think some of these issues can be anticipated? And you know, are the companies, the social media companies, open to having those sorts of conversations? So, I don't know, hypothetically, if you had an issue, a story you knew was going to break, an issue you knew was going to come up that you thought could lead to a player being targeted and abused, or I don't know if you know, sometimes there have been problems when, you know, clubs like United play in Eastern Europe, or where players get abused in stadiums. You know, are there certain fixtures where you think, well, we think probably abuse from opposing fans is more likely in this scenario? So we should, you know, could the company do things proactively to be looking out for likely problems?
I think the companies have got a lot better at knowing what the triggers are that causes this. And I think they will to some extent, adjust their monitoring and prioritize their monitoring for clubs and terms related to key players or clubs or matches because of that. So one of the key triggers we see is, you know, a high-profile player makes some sort of perceived error or mistake in a game, a missed penalty or an own goal or something like that. That can inevitably become a trigger, sadly, on social media. And the social platforms have got better at that, at anticipating it. But it doesn't seem... It seems to get better to a point. It doesn't seem to mean that they can really pour instantaneous resource into it on the moderation front and or proactively increase the speed of monitoring and taking down posts consistently. They do it sometimes, but it's doing it consistently.
Yeah.
I think that's where they could do a much better job, Charlie, because, you know, this is actually the heart of their business model. They make money out of contextual analytics in real time. So they will know that, you know, I've been on a website looking for a particular type of product and then suddenly an advert pops up in my Twitter feed or my Facebook feed. So the reality is actually you could be monitoring every player and monitoring commentaries of those games, which are, you know, text commentaries of those games, and you could see an incident and you could then anticipate and you could put warnings in for people when they're about as they're typing things. So the reality is they actually have all those technologies. They're just pointing them in other directions. They're all pointed in for the direction of commercial gain. And a lot of what we ask for is you need to point that same technology into a compliance domain because you actually have it already. You're just not using it for this purpose. And I think that's where, you know, I think there is a little bit of dissembling, a little bit of this is into the too hard category. And there's plenty more that they could be doing. And that's where we need to really be holding them to account on the detail of, well, here's something you could do. So as an example, you talked earlier about anonymity or no anonymity. Yeah, well, what about when someone actually says something that breaches your terms of service, which might be less than a criminal offence? Doesn't that put them on record? Can't you then require account verification and then bin the account after 30 days? Or even do it at the IP address level, even if you account for things like VPN. You know, the vast majority of these people, you know, particularly the kids, they won't necessarily be using that stuff. They'll just be doing it from their phone. And if you suddenly make the phone unavailable because you've banned the IP address, suddenly you started to change behaviours. So I think you really, ultimately, there's no substitute for getting right into the detail and saying, what about doing this? And what about doing this? And that's the way we hold their feet to the fire.
I think those are really, really great points to close on. I think particularly the point that, you know, a lot of the data that will be gathered to try and, you know, that will be necessary to take more effective action on this, they gather that data in a different way to make money. You know, they'll and they do have the technology which could be used to be more effective in this. And I think probably it's a question of creating the right regulatory environment where, rather than it being a request that they could, it's a regulator demanding that they do. But I think, Sanjay, Charlie, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And Charles, it's great to be with you again, as always.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Damien.
You've been listening to the Infotagen podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Sanjay Bhandari, Charlie Brooks, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also support the show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/InfotagenPodcast. Infotagen is a not-for-profit organization, and all of the proceeds will go towards the making of this show. Thank you. Until next time.